Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism.
The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello. Thanks for joining us for another dose of science-loving goodness here on Diffusion. I'm your polymath princess, Tilly Berlin, and this week I'll be guiding you through all the wonders of today's scientific intrigue and adventures. Over the next 30 minutes, we'll be gazing into the stars from the Antarctic and delving into the science of craniometry. So welcome, if you're listening to us in Sydney on 2SER or across Australia on the Community Radio Network, or you've used your technology know-how and you're potting us into your ears anywhere across the globe. Sit back and let my favourite news stewardess, Matt Clark, direct you to the nearest science overhead compartment, which will no doubt contain all the most highbrow science news for your pleasure.
We've all heard the age-old Navy saying that women and seamen don't mix. Well, it turns out there's a fair bit of truth in it. A recent US study performed on over 1,000 women has shown that possibly 13% of the fairer sex are allergic to their partner's semen. The culprit is not the sperm inside the semen, but the proteins which make up a large part of it. So far, there have been no reported deaths, although a number of cases requiring hospitalisation have been recorded. Typical symptoms are difficulty breathing, swelling, itching, and burning. Some of these are also symptomatic of a number of sexually transmitted diseases, which may lead to misdiagnosis, or for some embarrassed women, not reporting it at all. For the men inflicting their allergen-loaded semen on their partners, there is some good news though. In a typically male answer to the problem, the most effective treatment involves more sex. And lots of it. Although, you have to be careful what you wish for. Dr. David Resnick, who performed the study, says that they've had one case where the amount of sex required was too much for one poor husband to keep up with, and his wife developed the allergy again. The bane of gadget freaks and laptop users everywhere has long been the short life they get from their batteries. But it seems MIT assistant professor Marin Soljakic may just have the answer. Soljakic says he has developed a way to charge batteries without the need for them to be plugged in. In effect, recharging these devices wirelessly. Whilst most people would be familiar with wireless technology, such as mobile phones and wireless networking on laptops, however, providing energy without wires is a very different concept altogether, and is one that has stumped physicists for a long time. Energy has been transmitted wirelessly for decades, using microwave transmitters, although these have only worked in situations where minute amounts of power are needed. Charging something like a laptop battery takes a lot more juice. Using microwaves to transmit that much power would instantly cook anything that stumbled into its path. Soljakic believes he has gotten around this problem by using the non-radiative part of the electromagnetic field. This would be a key selling point for the technology, since it means you can walk in front of a transmitter and not be roasted alive. And lastly in this week's science news, we're now one step closer to never again needing real guitarists like Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix. Dr. Richard Helmer and his team from Australia's CSIRO have developed a t-shirt that will turn your lame air guitar actions in front of the mirror into real music. Chock full of tiny sensors, the shirt is able to measure the movement of your arms, which will allow you to play the virtual instrument as if you had a real one in your hands. When you move your arm, it bends a filament in the sensor, which changes its resistance, says Dr. Helmer. By moving one arm to choose the chords and the other to strum some imaginary strings, you can actually play music on it. Apart from being frustrated air guitarists, the team designed the shirt as part of their program on intelligent fabrics. They hope to be able to use this technology in areas like health monitoring and other, more serious fields. The only problem with a shirt guitar, of course, is you can't use it to smash your speakers and amps at the end of a show without looking like a crazy person putting out an invisible fire.
For more than 100 years, Australia has developed a strong reputation in the field of astronomy. From the development of the Sydney Observatory in the 19th century through to the more recent Anglo-Australian Telescope, Australia has led the way in astronomy. But now Australian astronomers are looking further afield to help the next generation of telescope. Darren Osborne reports on why Antarctica is seen as the next big thing for Australian astronomy.
For more than 10 years, astronomers have been travelling south to Antarctica as a potential site to build some of the newest and largest telescopes in the world. Professor John Storey from the University of New South Wales believes it's perfect for several reasons.
There are several reasons why Antarctica is the bee's knees. Firstly, because it's very cold. And so if you're doing infrared astronomy, where you're looking at the heat radiation from the stars and galaxies, then being in a place where there's very little heat radiation from the atmosphere or the telescope means that you've got much better sensitivity, much better contrast between the local sky and the things that you want to see out in space. The second reason is that the atmosphere over Antarctica is extraordinarily stable, and so the amount of turbulence, the twinkling of the stars and the distortion of the star images is very much reduced in Antarctica. And some of our measurements, in fact, have shown that we should be able to get images which are as crisp as the Hubble Space Telescope from a telescope sitting on the ground. And then the third reason is that for some kinds of astronomical observations, you'd like to be able to watch one star for long periods of time, days and days and days. And from most locations on Earth, of course, you're interrupted every 24 hours by the sun coming up.
One of the areas John and his team have been investigating is a place called Dome C, which is located on the high Antarctic plateau, 2,000 metres above sea level.
One of the things that I think surprises a lot of people about the Antarctic plateau is that the wind speed is extraordinarily low. People think of Antarctica as being an incredibly windy place. And indeed, around the coast of Antarctica, you can have winds in excess of 300 kilometres an hour. But Dome C and Dome A and up on the Antarctic plateau there, the wind is actually the lowest of anywhere on Earth.
But the advantages gained by observing in Antarctica come at a cost.
The main disadvantage of Antarctica is that the telescope is isolated, or at least the station is isolated, for about 8 months of the year. So from February through to November or October, the people who are down there with the telescope, pretty or completely isolated from the rest of the world. They've got radio communication, of course, via satellites, and you can send emails and so on. But if anything goes wrong, then you'd better have the spare parts down there and you'd better have the expertise and the people to fix it. So in that way, it's a little bit like a space mission.
So where to from here? In 2007, a small telescope built in Italy will begin observations, the first step towards what is hoped will be a much larger telescope.
We have an immediate proposal to put a 2.5-metre telescope in Antarctica, a telescope called Pilot. And PILOT actually stands for Pathfinder for an International Large Optical Telescope. And PILOT would be almost exactly the same size as Hubble. And from the measurements that we've made, we believe that it could produce images as sharp as Hubble can produce. And because it's a Pathfinder, if we can do this with a 2.5-metre telescope in Antarctica, then the next step would probably be an 8-metre, and then after that, a full 25-metre telescope.
Dr. Will Saunders from the Anglo-Australian Observatory is currently working on plans to develop one of these Antarctic observing giants, using a telescope which has a modern twist on an 80-year design.
It's a very fancy design. It was designed by a bloke, Bernard Schmidt, 80 years ago or something. He was this mad German, lived in Russia, created this incredible design for a telescope which has a mirror and a big lens. And it's an incredibly fancy lens. It's actually W-shaped. And it just gives you the best images over the biggest patch of sky of any telescope you can design. And there's been lots of them built, but you can't make them bigger than about 1.25 metres because you just can't make lenses bigger than that. They sag under their own weight. And what's happened quite recently is the Chinese are now building, they've broken through this barrier at one stroke. They've worked out how to use a mirror instead of this lens. And now there's no limit to how big you can build these telescopes. And it's the most exciting telescope being built in the world.
So what is the advantage of using a Schmidt-type telescope over some other designs?
It can image a very large patch of sky all at once. Most big telescopes just look at some little tiny patch of sky. But this is more like a pair of binoculars sees a big patch of sky all at once. And that's great if you're doing any sort of survey work, which is what Australia's always excelled in. is doing sky surveys, and you just need something that you can then map the whole sky. But the other great thing about this Chinese design is that it's just incredibly simple and cheap. It's for sure less than half the cost of a traditional telescope, and it doesn't have. It's very reliable. It's very simple. It has very few things to go wrong. Nothing really to keep carefully lined up with anything else.
Dr. Saunders believes that it's essential for Australia to take the lead in developing Antarctic-based telescopes if it wishes to maintain its hard-won reputation in astronomy.
The alternative is small shares in other people's telescopes in Chile. And if you only own 5 or 10% of a telescope, you can't do anything on it that the people who built it haven't already done first. You're just picking up the pieces, you know. And although you can keep some people's research careers going like that, you're not. What you're losing is the generation of students coming up, cutting their teeth on real astronomy and going on to have successful careers all over the world. If we don't have something in Antarctica, at least the small telescope, by about 2012, we're just going to lose all of that. Australia will have no reputation for observational astronomy.
That was Dr. Will Saunders speaking to Darren Osborne about plans to build an observatory in Antarctica.
Stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping, with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. It ain't getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind.
And that was Roy Scott featuring Dolly Parton and others. Throughout the history of science, many pseudo-scientific methods have been used to justify the stratification of society into a class system. This has even been performed by researchers of supposedly good intentions. Lachlan Watmore reports on the 19th century school of craniometry and its use as a social weapon.
Give me head, baby!
It's entirely understandable that people have tended to equate big brains with high intelligence. Look at the relative size of the human brain to those of other animals. We appear to jump off the scale in the expression of cranial capacity versus body weight. Our mental faculties certainly appear to be greater than those of other animals. We can reason, apply logic, and think in the abstract, which even chimpanzees cannot do. Therefore, taking that argument a step further, it would be illogical to assume that people with big brains would be more intelligent than those with small ones. The measurement of the skull and its contents is called craniometry, which had its heyday in the 19th century. Craniometry turned out to be one of the great schools of biological determinism, which basically states that a person's social status and economic fortune are the result of his or her genetic inheritance. In other words, people born smart will become rich and powerful, while those not so blessed will find their station in life further down the socioeconomic scale according to their mental endowment. Craniometry, as you can imagine, seemed to be the answer that racists and sexists had been looking for in order to quantify and therefore justify the lower social status of non-white people and, frequently, white women. If it could be proved that people of small status are simply occupying their natural social niche, then upper-class males could live their lives free of guilt and feel entirely justified in crushing rebellion from below. In the rigidly stratified society, which was 19th century Europe, a vast majority of people had their station in life fixed from birth. It was almost natural that researchers, despite the best of intentions, would make their conclusions before measuring a vast array of skulls of various ethnic groups. To a 19th century observer, it seemed obvious that blacks and women were inferior and that surely the craniometric data would indicate this. As a result, craniometry, despite diligent, honest measurement of cranial features, is a classic example of people's prejudices governing their observational criteria and analysis of data to produce a socially comfortable conclusion that could well be a load of bullshit. You give me head, you give me hands. The most famous craniometrician of the 1800s was the Frenchman Paul Broca. A surgeon by trade, he founded the Anthropological Society of Paris in 1859, the same year that Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species. There had been many craniometricians before Broca, but they had come before the theory of evolution had been espoused, and therefore had addressed the subject from a creationist standpoint. I'd like to concentrate on Broca because he regarded himself as both a liberal and an evolutionist, and therefore appears an unlikely bigot. Broca lived in an age when scientists were intoxicated by numbers. He himself was careful, honest, and meticulous in the laboratory, and his measurements frequently went to several decimal places. Despite making prior conclusions himself, he admonished his students to leave their hopes or prejudices at the door and draw their conclusions from the numbers, which was gross yet unconscious hypocrisy, given Broca's already drawn conclusions. Broca's motivation for studying skulls can be summed up in his own words. In an article published in 1861, he claimed that the great importance of craniology has struck anthropologists with such force that many among us have neglected the other parts of our science in order to devote ourselves almost exclusively to the study of skulls. In such data, we hope to find some information relevant to the intellectual value of the various human races. Note that Broca says relevant to the intellectual value. He is stating that intellectual values have already been arrived at and that craniometry is setting out to prove them. He is not leaving his prejudices at the door at all, despite later stating that it is an axiom of all observational sciences that facts must precede theories. Broca, as mentioned, was a faithful technician and used great care when generating data. He filled skulls with lead shot to assess their volume. The lead shot was then poured into a measuring cylinder to get a measurement. He also measured the dimensions of many skulls with respect to the relative sizes of different cranial parts. High intelligence was supposed to be indicated by a larger forebrain and smaller hindbrain, so Broca set out to show that non-whites and women had smaller frontal lobes than white men. Later, he addressed a different set of criteria that people with long faces and slightly elongated skulls are smarter than people with squarer heads. At almost every step, Broca found himself in highly embarrassing situations where his data were at odds with his assumptions, and only fancy theoretical footwork could get him out of it. For example, when addressing cranial volume, Broca found that most Asians have larger capacities than Europeans. He sidestepped this by saying that some lowly individuals have big brains, but all people with small brains are lowly. He pointed to measurements of Africans and native Australians and modified his argument, saying that brain size may not be the ultimate measure of intelligence, but was certainly significant. Broca also ran into trouble when advocating elongated skulls as the mark of intelligence. It turned out that black Africans and native Australians have the most elongated skulls. Once again, Broca neatly avoided embarrassment by stating that African and Australian elongation were due to the enlargement downwards of the hindbrain in these groups, that their forebrain was still small, and therefore they are inferior. Despite Brocker's fancy footwork, craniometry did not survive the 19th century. With so many contradictions and socially unacceptable data, the measurement of the skull and its contents was finally rejected in favour of mental tests as an intelligence indicator. Brocker should be given credit at this point for a separate achievement. He was one of the first to suggest the localization of mental processes within the brain, and to this day, a portion of the brain which enables the formulation of speech is called Brocker's convolution. To conclude, here is yet another example of a prior conclusion reached by the manipulation of criteria and data. It's not exactly what you call objective science.
That was Lachlan Watmore and the failures of craniometry. And now for the news that didn't quite make the news. Mark, have you got something for us?
Yes, thanks, Tilly. Here are some cultural learnings to make benefit the glorious nation of diffusion. And with the Ashes starting very soon, I thought we'd talk a little bit about cricket and psychology.
The Ashes start tomorrow, don't they?
The Ashes start tomorrow.
Bring it on.
Excellent.
The best batsman in the world, apparently, can predict the sort of ball a bowler is going to deliver before it even leaves his hands, a study of psychology shows.
They can't predict it from London, though.
No, they can't predict it from London, where one member of their Ashes team
or some kid's
is.
Man.
Yeah, good, okay. Good cricket knowledge.
Yeah, thank you.
What they've found is that the best batsman can predict the way a bowler is going to bowl just from his run-up and from the way he's holding his hands and his general body language.
So this is similar to a poker player being able to get a decent prediction on his opponent's hand by his facial expression and body movements, body language.
Yes, exactly right.
Cool. How are they doing? Are they studying tapes of the, guy? Or?
What they did, they put participants, including Steve Waugh and Ricky Ponting, the Australian captain, through a number of tests where they watched the bowler come in, and on the video, they stopped it. And then from where the bowler was, they guessed where they were going to bowl. And more often than not, they got it correct.
Now, I might be showing my age here, but Max Walker, if anyone remembers his run-up, I mean, you'd be completely stuffed trying to work out what he was doing.
I remember Maxie's run-up. There was a kind of a long lope, like a sort of a drunken gibbon. If I remember, correct me if I'm wrong here, but yeah, no, Maxie had a bit of a yee-woo over-the-shoulder type action.
He did. He bowled off the wrong foot as well, I seem to remember. Okay. And he had a good moustache, which Darren is sporting today. He's looking very Max Walker, actually.
And you're looking very fine too, Mark.
Apparently this is a good way of getting batsmen back into form as well. When they're out of form, they lose this ability, or their ability to read the body language is lessened.
Do you think that Ponting would have been such a good choice, given that Ponting's regarded, I think, along with Lara, one of the best batsmen in the world, and if anyone could predict how a ball is going to end up, it'd be him?
Well, I guess he proves the theory, I guess.
He certainly can't predict how a toss is going to end up.
We're having
serious... You know how during the Ashes he lost every freaking toss?
Oh, toss.
Oh, right. Jesus.
Surely if anyone had that ability, Bradman did, but you know, you can't go back there, can you?
Well, it's amazing. Bradman, many current experts these days think Bradman's technique wasn't all that good. And this is Diffusion Sports Show, whilst we're discussing all this. But yeah, apparently technically his technique was not that great. Maybe he had this ability.
Yeah, well, I suppose if you don't need the greatest technique, if you know what's going to come, you don't have to...
Exactly.
As long as you can put it away, it doesn't matter.
So if you're facing Tate, for example, I mean, he basically delivers the same ball every time.
Same with grass, so you know where it's going to go.
Was the research done on just fast bowlers, or was it done on spin bowling as well?
It looks like it was just done on fast bowlers, but spin bowling would bring a totally different... it's a totally different scenario. You'd have to not only be reading the body language, but reading the wrist, the position of the ball, the position of the hand.
And, of course, the thumb position of Shane Warne.
I'd defy anyone to try and to apply that to Warne at all. Forget about it. I don't think he'd even come close. I think that could really only work for pace or medium bowlers.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
But, you know, the swing of a cricket ball, reverse swing, can you predict that?
Well,
see, that's an interesting physics thing with boundary conditions, and I'm sure we'll talk about that at some other stage when the producer's not giving us the massive wind-up.
She looks so bored, doesn't she? Absolutely out of a tree with boredom.
She's just out of a depth, I think.
That's right, shoppers. Sadly, it's time to say goodbye from all of us here at Team Diffusion. If you'd like more information on any of the stories we've featured this week, or if you just want to send us some fan mail, you can drop us an email at diffusion@2ser.com. The voices that tantalised your ears this week were Mark West, Matthew Clark, Darren Osborne and Lachlan Watmore. Diffusion was produced and recorded by myself this week in the sumptuous studios of 2SER in Sydney. Diffusion is broadcast nationally via the Community Radio Network and all over the world through our podcast. You can now download our shows from www.diffusionradio.com. That's right, www.diffusionradio.com. Or you can subscribe to Diffusion on iTunes. We'll leave you now with Suddenly I See by Katie Tunstall. I'm Tilly Blinn, and I hope you'll join us next week for more fantastically fabulous science on Diffusion.
See her eyes looking from the page of a magazine. She makes me feel like